'cause I lost my job 2 weeks before Christmas. And I talked to Jesus at the sewer, and the Pope said it was none of his goddamn business. While the rain drank champagne, my Estonian archangel came and got me wasted. 'Cause the sweetest kiss I ever got is the one I've never tasted. Oh, but they'll take their bonus pay to Molly McDonald. Neon lady, beauty's that which obeys, is bought or borrowed. Cause my heart's become a crooked hotel, full of rumors, but it's I who pays the rent for these fingered face out-of-tuners. And I make 16 solid half-hour friendships every evening. Cause your queen of hearts, who's half a stone and likes to laugh alone, is always threatening you with leaving. Oh, but they'll play those token games on Willie Thompson and give a medal to replace the sun of Mrs. Annie Johnson.
That's Sixto Rodriguez, the sixth child of working-class Mexican immigrants who made a home for themselves and their family in Detroit. That's where he was born and still lives, and that's his song called Cause. Some of his songs were standards for the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, and ironically, it was his popularity abroad, specifically in South Africa and Zimbabwe and in Australia, particularly, that reignited his singing career. But as you can tell, his voice remains vibrantly youthful, even though he is 71 years old now. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead. It is Friday, January the 3rd of this new year, 2014. And the case of Jahai McMath, which we discussed yesterday, went before a federal mediation judge today in hopes that a solution could be found to safely transfer the child from the Children's Hospital of Oakland to a long-term care facility in Medford, New York, that has agreed to accept her. 13-year-old Jahai had surgery at the hospital to remove her tonsils and tissue from her throat and nasal passages. 3 days later, on December the 12th, she began to bleed profusely, then went into cardiac arrest, and then was declared brain dead by doctors. The hospital saying that she was a deceased person attached to a ventilator, sought to remove her from life support, but Jahai's mother, Nyla Winkfield, and family members obtained a restraining order saying she disputed the finding of the so-called whole brain death of Jahai and wants to remove her child from the hospital to a facility that will take care of her. But to do that, Jahai must have breathing and feeding tubes inserted. The hospital says it will not perform such a procedure on a dead person, and so far, no independent physician has agreed to do it. No word yet on the outcome of today's mediation hearing. Today, I want to talk about something that will be, for me, a recurring feature. I'm going to come back to the subject, adding more and more as I go, to this dramatic shift that will occur and that has begun, actually, and that the Census Bureau says will reach its high point, its apex, in the year 2043. That's just a hop, skip, and jump away from where we are now. By 2043, the Census Bureau says, the United States will be the first industrial nation with a majority non-white population. But there are signs that it would actually happen sooner. What we will be talking about, this is the first part of it. I'm just going to get into some statistical figures just to get the subject going, and you'll see where I'm going, hopefully. But what I want to come out of this question is, how does a society, in as much as this change is going to occur, and it will be dramatic, and it will be traumatic, psychologically traumatic, how does a society created and governed and maintained by the false construct of race and later class, how does such a country make this transition? Is it to be expected that it would be a nice, easy, smooth process and we'll all hold hands and walk off into the sunset? Or will we experience some serious adjustment problems? Well, let's take a look at where things are statistically. As of January the 2nd, 2014, this year, the United States population stands at 317,387,000. It is the third most populous country in the world. But there are some interesting things about this country, as we know. It was founded and predicated on very bizarre theories and very bizarre notions that were absolutely indelibly etched into the structure of our society. It was inculcated via our social norms, our attitudes that have been shaped accordingly by those in power, and underscored and enforced by law. This country, in so many ways, is a pattern for the kind of strange existence that we see in other countries that are incomprehensible, like Israel and Palestine, or South Africa, during the days when essentially the settlers ruled everything. And the people who were there were just hostages performing the menial tasks. But by 2043, this shift is supposed to change dramatically the demographic makeup and outlook of America. Well, right now, 14 states already have gone that way. The 14 states have already, in effect, achieved that racial transition. They've already gone through that. four states, and I'm exempting Hawaii because Hawaii has never been a majority white state. But apart from Hawaii, New Mexico, California, and Texas are already majority minority states. That is to say, these are states in which non-white populations dominate numerically. That's very impressive. And when we start talking about these figures, you'll be able to make some connections. You'll say, oh, wow, that's interesting. 14 states are, as of 2012, they already have within them, germinated already, the makings of majority-minority populations, because right now, in fact, 2012 was the year in which these states had crossed over the demographic profile and changed the demographic profile. These states now have more toddlers. They're calling them toddler populations. That's children under the age of five. And that population comprises the demographic change that will manifest itself several years hence, as these would be the people who are then going to be having children by 2043. But these states, these 14 states, have already crossed that demographic shift. They include Hawaii, of course, New Mexico, California, the District of Columbia, which used to be a majority-minority city. It no longer is, in the sense that it's no longer a black city as such, because there has been gentrification to some degree. And, however, among the new populations coming into D.C., which still keeps it a majority-minority city, are Latinos and Asians. So you have Washington, D.C., you have Texas, Nevada, Arizona, Maryland, Florida, Georgia, New Jersey, New York, Mississippi, and Delaware. These 14 states have already begun the shift. They have already gone on the map. So if you add these 14 states and you add the four other states, you come up with a sizable portion of America that is well on its way to changing the demography of the United States. That is quite impressive. Generally across the United States, in these particular states that I'm going to be talking about here now, the percentage of non-Hispanic white residents has fallen below 60%. And these states include Maryland, Georgia, Nevada, Florida, Arizona, New York, New Jersey, Mississippi, and Louisiana, according to the 2010 census. So, you getting the sense? Things are changing. We're not seeing it, but they're changing. All of the U.S. territories, which would include Puerto Rico, Guam, the U.S. Virgin Islands, the Northern Mariana Islands, and American Samoa, they always have been majority-minority territories. They never, ever did have a white majority in these territories. So for all intents and purposes, let's say you put those in the pot, and you begin to see what is happening. 13 of the 40 largest metropolitan statistical areas in the United States are majority-minority right now. And an additional 7 of these areas are have a population, a non-Hispanic white population, below 60%. So that is to say, almost half of the 40 largest metropolitan areas in the United States have a white population below 60% right now. And as of 2011, 11% of the country's 3,141 counties can already be said to be majority-minority counties. And an additional 7%, that is 218 additional counties, are said to have reached what they call the tipping point toward being majority-minority. In these counties, between 40% and 50% of the population in those counties are so-called minorities. This is very, very shocking, because you never think this, you know, you would never think this. So the whole of the United States is projected to become majority-minority by 2043. And as we discussed, in 40 of these states already, the children of these states have already put these 14 states along the path. They are already on the path to the demographic shift. But according to the Census Bureau, minority children will be the majority in the entire United States by 2019. Let me repeat that. Minority children will be the majority in the entire United States by 2019. This is very significant news. Why? Because 2043, people are focused on 2043. Oh my gosh, that's way down the road. We don't need to get all excited about that right now. But in fact, when you look at the census figures, they're telling us that the shift has already begun. The shift has already begun. Now, there's no reason to run to the hills. Or maybe there is, I don't know. Maybe there is. But the thing is that I'm going to start discussing what is going to happen to the psyche of America as this shift becomes more and more evident. Now, regular folks, we don't know this stuff. We don't walk around, you know, and first chance we get, we go to the library and look up stuff, or we get online and we look up stuff just to find out where we are. We just go about our lives. But while we're doing this, this process has already begun, and it cannot and will not be stopped. What is happening in white America is that for the first time, the deaths actually exceed the births. And this is a phenomenon happening in Europe as well. In fact, in some countries, there has been what they call negative population growth. People are just not having children. And so the influx of immigrants is changing the dynamic in these countries, and there is a huge backlash occurring because, number one, people are now physically feeling the presence of the others, people who they deem to be undesirable for all kinds of reasons. And then it begins to trigger a whole number of other reactions that have to do with fear, that have to do with xenophobic feelings, that have to do with the notion of losing control. Now, these are facts drawn from the Census Bureau. America is, in fact, moving And the demographers have already seen and have already begun to track the changes that are occurring. Now, let's kind of backtrack a little bit and include a little bit of U.S. history here. The country, from its very beginning, was rooted in this false construct of racial supremacy. White Anglo-Saxon Protestants ruled the country, they founded it, and they are the keepers of the country. Now, that was based on, one, the numerical advantage. A country was formed in such a way as to give a group a numerical advantage. Okay, certainly they did not include the First Nations in this country as part of America. So one group dominated and has dominated for, what, 238 years now. I'm talking only from 1776, okay? I'm not going back to the 1600s, although I should. But I'm talking just in recent historical memory. The people who formed the country also formulated our attitudes about the country. And from this, nobody escaped. Black, white, and polka dot, we all were shaped by these false constructs. One group said, we are superior, and therefore ordained by God, and you could never argue with God, ordained by God to be in control. The other group also was ordained by God to be slaves forever and to obey the law of the land. Whether it was a just law is a whole other question. It's like Obamacare. It's the law. Well, yeah, we've had to live with that for 238 years for the specific purpose of maintaining racial supremacy by one group and racial inferiority by all other groups. Now, I've talked about this business of how we measure our society, how we calibrate our place in this society. And we do so by taking a look, a good clinical look, at the quality of access we have to the basics, to the strategic resources of the society. That is, those resources that presumably anyone in a civilized world, and this, of course, is also upheld by international conventions, these are the basics. You should have these basics. You should have food security. You should be able to eat every day. You should have shelter, affordable housing. You should have gainful employment so that you can provide for your needs and the needs of those that are near you and dear to you. You should have a sound education, which makes you a useful citizen and makes you an enlightened human being, a very good contributor to society. You should have good access to health care. We are not going to discuss that again. And you should have safety. You should be able to feel okay about being in your house, walking down the street, unmolested, not being shot at by the cops or anybody else. You should have some degree of safety and security, personal security. That's the few that I have arbitrarily decided are the most important things that you should have. And if you can measure a society and the way it functions, you measure it by these few yardsticks. And we know what the result would be if we were to undertake an examination of these resources and how or which groups have access, which groups do not. Now, I raise that to say it is the standing equation, the standard rule that those who have power also have access, unfettered access, unlimited access sometimes, to strategic resources. Indeed, they are part of the system of government that regulates these resources. So it stands to reason that psychologically, those who are in power, or those who see themselves as belonging to the group that is in power, also see themselves as entitled to share in the resources. And zero-sum thinking, which I've talked about before, if they are to have resources, and if the resources are to be shared, the resources certainly are not to be shared equally, because that would mean a diminution in their power. So part of their power is expressed by keeping resources to themselves and forbidding others or preventing others from having meaningful access or any access at all to these resources. So the Occupy movement, for example, was correct. 1% of America sees itself as worthy of 99% of the wealth. And this, in their view, is fair. Now, if this is the psychological orientation, not just that group has, but everybody has that, everybody in some way calibrates their reality toward what stands as the givens that we have to work with. In other words, as an African-American person, I am schooled, I am trained, even in my family, I would have to resist the constant bombardment that somehow or the other I am not equal to those who are powerful or those who can easily belong to the powerful group. See, so I'm affected that way. I internalize the lessening of my value, and I accept it. On the flip side, a guy like Ed Snowden feels perfectly comfortable addressing the president of Brazil as an equal, or the president of the United States as an equal. That is an inculcated value based on the perception of belonging to the power group. So imagine if these things are true in a scenario where the shift, the demographic shift, is not as readily seen, is not as concrete, is not as visible, is not as universal as the statistics tell us. Imagine if this is what obtains without the demographic shift being pronounced real. Imagine what would happen when, in fact, we get closer and closer to 2043. How would a population used to being in charge, used to having power, used to having control over resources that are supposed to be nationally available, available to everyone in a democratic way, how would a population with that sensibility, with the inculcation of that kind of attitude about what is their entitlement, how would they adjust? What would be the psychological reaction to the reality of being outnumbered? And what would be the consequence of that internalization, the internalization of that reality? What would be the consequence to others who did not belong in that group or were never seen to be members of the group, or were not given permission to be members of the power group? Are we going to see a situation where, despite a numerical change, the fight is going to be over the smaller group, the outnumbered group, doing everything it can in its power to hold on to power and control. And this larger group decided, well, okay, as long as my basic needs are met, I'm okay with it. So that essentially the numerical change will not change the power equation. The power equation will remain the same, but the numerical change, will have certain adjustments. Maybe they'll start, celebrating different so-called ethnic holidays and so forth as a concession. But can we count on that? Can we count on the psychological stability of a group that is in charge, that they will not go nuts, that will not freak out over the loss of ground? This is huge. It has happened already, and it's going to happen more and more in the next couple of years. And even if the power elite were to multiply like rabbits between now and the next 10 years, they still would not outnumber the people who historically have been marginalized and cast to the periphery as being unimportant in the society, except as cogs in a pre-designed wheel. So, what you need to look at are the little hints of such conduct. And they're terrifying. We see them, for example, we've talked about a runaway Supreme Court. The Supreme Court making really strange decisions. The Voting Rights Act, for example, and other legislation, affirmative action, all the things associated with the ability of the underclass, the undesired and the undesirables, the ability of this group to gain access to resources through the courts. So we could expect that there will be a reaction at that level. And more and more, as you see these cases come before the Supreme Court, they hint of a recognition, not that they differ with the law or they differ with the concept. What they are expressing, without actually having it literally said, is that they are aware that some legislation coming, a lot of legislation coming before the courts, are coming from these people who eventually, numerically, will outnumber the people who are customarily in power and in charge. So a lot of things are going to be done now, and you'll see them, they'll creep up, and they will look very disconnected from each other. But really, they are an expression of a kind of fear that will build to a greater and greater degree the more the demographic shift evidences itself in terms of black and brown and yellow faces showing up where they, quote, are not supposed to be, unquote, having power they're not supposed to have. There are some things that we ignore because we don't see them as being connected. You know, we don't see them as being part of the story of this traumatic shift that will have incredible impact on everybody. Are we ready for it? Or, better still, can we even get ready for it? That's the question I pose to you today. 888-874-4888. Let's talk about this first installment as we talk about the demographic shift that will occur, supposedly, according to the Census Bureau, by 2043, but which is beginning to evidence itself, and with it, some really interesting things about the behavior, though, the likely behavior of the power elite. Right after this very short musical break, more of my good, wonderful musician friend here. His name is Sixto, S-I-X-T-O, Sixto Rodriguez. Sixto is Spanish for six. He is the sixth child. So some more. By the way, he's from Detroit. I'd like to mention that. Let's hear a little bit more of Sixto, and I'll take your calls and comments at 888-874-4888 as soon as we get the first call.
Everybody's got to pay their dues, and I explained that I had overpaid them. So overdue, I went to the company store, and the clerk there said that they had just been invaded. So I set sail in a teardrop and escape beneath the door sill. Cause the smell of her perfume echoes in my head still. I see my people trying to drown the sun in weekends of whiskey sours. Cause how many times can you wake up in this comic book and plant flowers?
Sixto Rodriguez with Cause. You're listening to PRN.FM. This is Lead Stories. I'm your humble servant, Nutrice Lead, and we have DX on the line. You're on the air.
Hello, Nutrice. How are you today?
Fine, thank you today. Thank you.
Good. I wanted to say Happy New Year to you and to all your listeners as well.
Thank you.
That was a beautiful song you just played. Very nice.
Thanks. He's a very powerful Bob Dylan type, but, he's been at it in his own way. Really powerful music
right.
That he makes.
Yeah, that was lovely. I like that. I wanted to talk about this reaction of the elite. I think you already see it in many ways, and just like on a lot of issues, they've beaten us to the punch on this one, too. Because all you have to do is look around, you know, it's getting worse and worse every day. I mean, this is the reason why we have prisons, for one thing, that are being built every day. And, you know, the way they're going to get around it, or the way they propose to get around it, or lessen the impact of this effect, is that they're going to impoverish or lock up or kill, basically, or this is their reaction to it. And you can see it in so many ways. I think the prisons are one. You know, they build them more and more every day. They're passing laws in certain states where they give deals to private companies where they'll keep the prison 90% stocked and stuff like that. I mean, that's one reaction. Then we see another reaction with cities like Detroit, which is the template for what they're going to be doing with other majority black and majority minority cities. I mean, this is how they're going to do it. And we also see it in the inner cities where the minority communities are being impoverished, starved, the schools are being, the funding's being cut. I mean, they've been up to this for years because they've seen this down the road. They've seen this coming. And so this is why we have all these things happening.
Well, actually, you're right on the head of the nail here. That is part of the In fact, that was part of the presentation for a couple lectures down the road. But with 219,000 people in federal prison, just in the last decade, a 27% increase, and we have a total population now of more than 2.2 million people in prisons and jails in the United States, a 500% increase in the last 30 years, and the population is very much race-based. However, exactly. Something interesting is happening, and this is where I think this is where a very interesting dialogue should begin, because we have the lumping now. At least it's getting. I don't know if you agree about this, but more and more working white people are beginning to see and feel themselves as others. The privileges are not being accorded even to them. So a groundswell has been building, and more people are identifying on the basis of their economic status. But the question is,
absolutely,
and will class win over race? You see,
and that's used, I believe, sometimes, most of the time, to mask the fact that really the targeting of minorities is going on. But they use the economic status of people to just say, well, it's not racial here. This is just this. You know what I mean? So, so I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, another thing you spoke of earlier is absolutely true as well. I mean, all these weird rulings from the Supreme Court. I mean, they're trying to overturn, because they see that, you know, this is how people react when they're frightened, afraid, because they don't want the people to have the power to affect any kind of positive change in their direction. So what they're attacking it from all kinds of areas, all kinds of ways, is what I'm telling you. They've planned this, and they've been doing this for years. And like you mentioned,
let me ask you this though: considering, let's say that you get the picture, what is this window of opportunity that is being afforded here, and who should take advantage of it, and how?
By window of opportunity, you mean
with this demographic shift,
changing demographic?
A writer just said, I just got a note on leadstories@gmail. Utrice, you're speaking today of the demographic shift. Are we to assume that the shift is about to hit the fan? Yes. The shift is about to hit the fan. But considering that the shift is about to hit the fan, what therefore is the challenge to, let's say, the progressive groups and or the different groups that you see that should be responding in a different way than the way we're responding now?
I think this is exactly where local power, wielding your power locally, can help. I mean, this is exactly like in especially in major metropolitan areas and even some smaller towns or whatever, especially these states in the South, this can be very effective as a local grassroots type of, if people would just have that mentality where they talk to their neighbors and they get together and they do positive construction things and elect people in their cities and their mayors and their city councils that are progressive, we can do that. Because as I said before when I've called, I think we're totally done federally. I mean, there's nothing you can do with their bogus elections because it's always rigged. You get a third party in of somebody who wants to do something positive like the Green Party and people like that. Ralph Nader, they shut him out a couple of times. They're always going to do that. You know, and you can, because they control the power at the federal level. So I think locally is where we fight, and that's the only place we can fight right now.
Thank you, sir. Thanks so much for your call today and for your input.
You have-
Patricia, you're on the air.
Good evening. Good afternoon, you trees. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
You know, I just want to throw this out. I am a women's healthcare practitioner, and about a month ago, I attended a forum that was entitled Latino Immigration, U.S. Policy, and Reproductive Health. What's the connection? So, of course, because I was I'm a healthcare provider, I attended the conference. And lo and behold, one of the participants at the conference, someone you know well, Juan Gonzalez, was screening his the Harvest of the Empire. And for those who are not aware, Harvest of the Empire is a documentary that talks about U.S. immigration policy towards Latin America and why there's so much immigration here into this country. And he said something that has just remained with me. You're the second person I've heard in 4 weeks talk about the change in demographics of this country. And what he said was that, I don't remember the exact number, but he talked about how many Hispanic children are born every day and what that would mean in terms of U.S. policy going forward. And as I sat there and I listened to him, I said, wait a minute. That means that blacks are nowhere on this, are nowhere on the agenda. Because it really depends, you know, this black and brown unity that we should have, no one ever talks about. We don't have it. We, you know, African Americans have aided Hispanics in their quest for policies that are sensitive to their issues. But there's never that reciprocal relationship of Latinos to African Americans. And as I sat there that day, I was struck with the fact that it depends on how your question is, what is the response going to be of European Americans? Well, it really depends a lot on the shift in terms of where Hispanics see themselves in relation to European Americans, because that's what's going to affect what happens to us. Because unfortunately, you know, I listened to Brother Maddox, and he says that education, political education precedes political representation. And when I, you know, as we watched Mandela be buried a few weeks ago, and how Mandela would never have voted for white minority rule in South Africa, and yet still in New York, African Americans voted for white minority rule here in New York. And so we have a long way to go in terms of understanding the issues and how we address issues, whereas Hispanics, they are singular in purpose. Which means because they are singular in purpose, that black and brown coalition that should exist does not exist. And that day I said, I don't know if it will ever exist.
Well, you know, this is also, it also has a wider application. For example, in the African-American community, there is a very wide gap between African Americans and Caribbean Americans and continental Africans who see the world very differently. And there isn't I don't sense it, that there has been a congealing of effort. I still see this factionalism and people drawing these cultural lines that divide. You know, so is it something that, particularly pertaining to immigrants who have a goal or something that they're hell-bent on achieving and everything else is subsumed? I don't know. But I've talked about it often enough that Caribbean Americans generally do not value or do not understand the need to value and to acknowledge the value of the struggles of African Americans, who paved the way for people to come and pursue their dreams. You get a lot of ethnic, you know, static here. You don't find so?
I do, because my background is West Indian as well, and I cannot begin to tell you what I fight against within my own, you know, family structure. I talk about Africa all the time and our connection to Africa, and they don't want to hear anything about a connection to Africa. They feel as though their connection started in Jamaica without any construct with where they came from to Jamaica.
And even among Latinos, I mean, the Dominicans
are
not particularly close to Puerto Ricans, and they're not particularly close to Cubans, and the Cubans are not particularly close to Venezuelans and Argentinians and so forth. There's a lot of balkanization within cultures that have prevented them from really forging a common path.
So for me, if I had one wish in this coming year, it would be that somehow there has to be a way to educate folks. There just has to be. You know, I mean, what happened here in New York City this past mayoral election in terms of the inability for the Freedom Party candidate to have access to the airways, just to say that I'm running, whether you agree with my platform or not, to say that I'm running and I have a right to have my agenda promoted as an agenda. Just even that fight, which was an unsuccessful one, says to me that we are just so uninformed and unenlightened. And for me, that's where the fight begins, with education, political
Absolutely.
Education.
No question. Thank you so much, Patricia. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Calling in and making that incredible contribution today, too. Thank you so much. This is from Lead Stories. I totally agree with you and Patricia with regard to the dynamic shift that will affect us in the future, says Nad Denswa Dako. Great. Thank you so much for your note. Well, that brings us close to the end of our program today. I'll be making just some closing comments. This today is just the first bit of things to consider as we get to this question about what this demographic shift is likely to produce, not only between the so-called majority and dominant power elite and the rest of us, but also, as we've just discussed, within our groups as well. There's a lot of fragmentation that could get in the way of a healthy approach to the demographic shift. We will get into ensuing discussions about it. We'll be talking about how do we situate ourselves politically. So let's say you consider yourself not a Democrat or run-of-the-mill Democrat or run-of-the-mill Republican or run-of-the-mill anything, but you consider yourself more on the activist or advocacy side of things. How do you respond to it now? Where do you see the evidence that things are already afoot? Where are they expressing themselves? Where are they visible? And in each situation where we have a burgeoning crisis, you also have an opportunity to really do something, to get into the action, as it were, and to do something. What will that something be, and how is it to be achieved? This is what I mean, that you can't think in terms of 2-year increments or 4-year increments. You have to take the long haul. The nation is looking to 2043, but it's also looking to 2050 and beyond. We have to develop a long view and take a look at how we prepare ourselves for the long view. So with those remarks, I want to thank you so much for listening today. I hope you found some value. You can always drop me a line at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with you, Trace Lead. And on Monday, we get back to brass tacks. There's a lot to report on New York and, of course, the city of Detroit. Some really interesting things are happening there. So on Monday, we'll get back into the swing of things with those discussions. I really want to thank you so much for offering such extraordinarily deep and profound observations. It really elevates the level of discussion that we have here, and I really appreciate it. I'm very proud to be associated with a program with such incredibly intellectual people. Thank you. You make me look good. I ain't all that smart, but you make me look good. So thank you so much. Have yourselves a good weekend, and we'll see each other on Monday. Thank you so much for listening. And we go out with Sixto Rodriguez.